Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much of success boils down to being in the right place at the right time? And what does it take to position oneself to take advantage of good luck when it comes around? My guest today believes serendipity will play an ever greater role in shaping our fast-changing economic and technological climate. And while nobody can make luck happen, he says it is possible to position oneself to be ready to act and to benefit when random good fortune strikes. Entrepreneur and strategy consultant Franz Johansson explains all this in his new book, The Click Moment, Seizing Opportunity in an Unpredictable World. Franz, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris.
So tell us what a click moment is exactly and why we might lose the opportunity to benefit from one if we're not ready.
Well, the click moment, in the book I talk about these, and essentially it sets itself up as obliterating the idea that in business or in life, essentially, you can plan, strategize, or analyze your way to success. Instead, success has far more to do with serendipity and randomness than we'd sort of like to believe. And so most of the book I sort of explore how do you actually harness randomness? How do you harness serendipity to your advantage? And most of it turns on these specific moments in time when we have an unexpected meeting, an unexpected insight, a client that took us in a way that we didn't expect, but something that takes us off into a different path than the one we had planned to travel down. And those moments are what essentially makes or breaks companies from Microsoft to, you know, individual careers, and probably both you and me and everybody else that listens to this.
You know, we're trained to sort of hate the idea that success might be random, but what you're not saying that it doesn't matter that one has talent, that one is ready to work hard. In fact, those things matter all the more when luck comes around.
Well, so there's several pieces to that. I mean, first of all, with skill, there are certain areas where skill actually is extremely indicative and predictive of success. And I talked about that early in the book. Somebody like Serena Williams right now, playing in the U.S. Open, for instance, she is the result of years, decades of intense training in tennis. She says she doesn't even remember her first memory of playing tennis. And this goes along with what, you know, this notion that ultimately Malcolm Gladwell popularized called the 10,000-hour rule. And it works. I mean, it's true. The fact is that this is, if you want to be good at tennis, you really got to have to focus intensely on becoming good in tennis. But there's also a particular reason why it works for tennis and for chess and for sports in general. And that is that society has decided that the rules for tennis should not change. It should remain the same. Over the past 50 years, there's been maybe three major rules changes in tennis. And that means that you can predict exactly what you need to do in order to win a tennis. You need to have a really strong serve. You need to be able to play a good baseline and so on. This fact is not true for basically anywhere else. The rules for media, the rules for phone companies, the rules for journalism are changing all the time, and we're unable to predict in what way. And so skill here all of a sudden becomes far less important. Hard work does not, and there's a reason for that that I'll get to later. But skill itself, I mean, if you were excellent in writing, for instance, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to become end up at the top of the heap of writers. I have another example in the book of Stephanie Meyer, who wrote Twilight. She hadn't written a word for 6 years, and she ended up writing one of biggest bestsellers of all time. Having a great skill in writing, which she acknowledges that she does not have, was not necessarily a prerequisite.
And there's also the example on the other side of the cellular phone company Nokia, which was known all over the world for making these really high quality, indestructible phones, and one would have assumed them to stay at the top of the heap, but something changed.
Yeah, so it's a great. I think this is a great example. Nokia is fantastic because in 2006, they were the number one mobile phone company in the world. They were the number one brand in Europe, number one five worldwide, three times larger profits than the next competitor, which was Motorola. I think if you had at that time, at that moment, told a Nokia executive that in a couple of years, Apple's greatest competitor in the mobile space is going to be Google, I think they would have been stunned. They wouldn't have believed you because neither one of those companies were even in the mobile world at that time. Hmm. And here's the thing. For Nokia, they understood the rules of the game as they saw it then. Phones needed to be slick-looking. They needed to have cool colors and cool ringtones. And within just a year, all that changed. Nobody cared about the color of the phone because they all looked the same. They're these dark, black slate-looking things. They look like bricks, essentially. It was all about the operating system. And they couldn't really, it was impossible to foresee. And once the rules changed, they were all of a sudden at the end of the pack. They were running last and are sort of quickly working their way into possibly complete failure.
And so not only can one not follow someone else's success to the letter and assume that you will have similar success, you can't even sort of rest on your past record necessarily, particularly in any field that requires innovation.
That's right. Nokia, the example was clear. They thought they understood the field. They thought they understood the industry. But because success is random, they weren't really opening themselves up for the serendipity. Within Nokia, of course, there's all kinds of different ideas, but they simply said, we have this down, and we said we're going to execute according to that. Not only that, what's even more interesting is that just because you can understand certain trend lines for the future, you might think that's going to help you. But that's not true either. So, for instance, I knew when I was writing this book that far more people were going to read this book on the Kindle. The Click Moment was going to be read on the Kindle far more than for The Medici Effect, which was the first book I wrote. But how does that help me, this understanding of this trend? It doesn't really, because all other authors know this as well. And so, when Apple came out with the iPad, for instance, it became obvious that tablets are now back. Okay? And within 18 months, you had over 60 companies that had developed over 100 different tablets, and none of them made any real money. Just because you can predict a trend doesn't mean that you're going to set you apart, because if everybody else can predict it as well, you're really just staying in the same place. And that's why the discoveries that we make that are unexpected, those are truly the ones that set us apart. Serendipity, in fact, is what sets us apart.
And the Amazon Kindle is actually an interesting business case because it's a good example, you say, of taking the smallest step possible towards something that might pan out and might, in fact, flame out.
Well, yeah. When I talk to people about this, they say, okay, this actually, I recognize what you say about the world, right? It is that the world is unpredictable. In fact, many people will be hard-pressed to say that this is a controversial statement. But then you turn around and say, well, the implications of that is that you can't plan or analyze your way to success. And so for some people that seems a bit controversial, but actually this is two sides of the same coin. And so the most of the book I spend talking about how do you actually live in an unpredictable world? How do you succeed in an unpredictable world? And what you need to do is actually increase the amount of serendipity. You need to increase the amount of randomness. Hmm. And what Amazon did was that they essentially said, and Bezos has said this, we're not sure what's going to work or not work, but we want to try. We want to try to figure it out. And so they placed these bets, a number of different bets, and in this case, Kindle was such a bet. But if you think about it, it means logically that the more bets you can place, the better off you are. Okay, fair enough, but that means they have to actually decrease the size of each bet. And so what he did with the Kindle was he placed a bet. It was pretty small. He wanted to see if there was something to this. Turns out there was. And now, of course, it is one of the most dominant new business, not just business divisions, but products that they have.
Yeah, and another thing that that they did with the Kindle was to make sure that what they were doing really was instead of looking at what return they would get on their investment, they looked at how much they could afford to lose on this bet should it not work out.
Yeah, people all the time want to try to create a return on investment in order to help them understand which decision they should make. Should it do this one or that one? Let's look at the ROI. Whichever is the greatest is the one we're going to pursue. Well, in an unpredictable world, the ROI measure is essentially useless. We still want to rely on it. you know, I get this all the time from executives everywhere. Well, I mean, what else are we going to go on? And is it, well, if it's not a reliable measure, you're not going to be able to use it. So what should you use instead? And I talk about two other things. One is, well, look, can you, if you make this bet and it doesn't work, are you still going to be okay? That's what's called affordable loss. And that's how Bezos essentially looked at this. The ability to place many bets and make sure that if they didn't work out, you'd still be okay. So that's one aspect of it. There's several other metrics to look at, but that's how they thought about the Kindle.
A great example in the book is Mark Zuckerberg, who, of course, is famous as the founder of Facebook. Things are not going so well for Facebook right now. But
right.
Initially, he saw Facebook's value, you write, as a platform for this long-forgotten software application.
Yeah, I mean, this I think is hilarious, but it goes to the heart of almost every success. It's just that we tend to think, when somebody like Mark Zuckerberg comes along, that, you know, it's this brilliant genius that allowed him to sort of see the future, and he saw something about the world, that, you know, the social network of the world, and he tapped into that. But it's not true. He created Facebook, great, but what's been revealed, of course, is that he actually had the science on another company, because he didn't think Facebook was really going to be the big deal. It was something else called WireHog. And WireHog was meant to essentially help people share files online. Now, if you just reflect on that for a second, so you have, on one hand, you have Facebook that's taking off. On the other, you have the idea of sharing files online. And Zuckerberg thinks that it is sharing files that's going to be the, sort of the big deal. Of course, he changed his mind once Facebook truly sort of just absolutely took off in tremendous fashion. But what it illustrates, I mention this story is because even the smartest among us don't really know what it's going to take to succeed in a world where the rules keep changing.
Hmm.
You can't use the past to understand what's going to work in the future. And so you have to be open for randomness. You have to be open for serendipity. And you have to double down on those things to take off.
Yeah, and had Zuckerberg been sort of single-mindedly focused on WireHog, we would not know his name today.
Right. I mean, he would have sold Facebook, and then he'd started WireHog, and it would have been, you know, it would have just been another serial entrepreneur. He didn't do that, of course, and so, you know, it's worked out really well for him. But this comes through over and over and over again. We tend to think that people that are exceptionally successful, they've figured it all out. It's not true. You have John Paulson. You know, he was the guy that sort of bet against the housing market, and he made $15 billion in a year because of that bet for his firm. He himself came out with something like $4 billion. What a brilliant genius, right? I mean, that must be the conclusion. I mean, he analyzed the charts, and he did something that no other investment bank did, despite the fact that they had hundreds of analysts looking into the same market. Well, okay, but if he was that brilliant, why isn't he able to actually find other types of insights like this? It turns out that, you know, today he is with his mutual fund, or his new fund, he's down over 50%. He's lost over 50% of the value in that. In the end, I think it comes from the fact that he understood something about the market then, and he bet on it, but that was a random insight, and I go through that in the book, the lucky idea that sort of hit him, and it just hasn't happened again for something else.
Frans Johansson is with us. His new book is called The Click Moment, Seizing Opportunity in an Unpredictable World. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is entrepreneur and strategy consultant Franz Johansson. He's the author of the new book, The Click Moment, Seizing Opportunity in an Unpredictable World. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Franz, talk about what it takes to cultivate click moments in our lives and in our careers.
Yeah. The natural instinct when we try to reach success is we want to plan, we want to analyze, and we want to strategize to get there. And so obviously in the book I really sort of take a big hammer at that because in today's world serendipity and randomness is far more important. And I talk about three different approaches in the click moment of how to do that. The first one is how to actually increase the number of click moments that are in your life. One of the clearest way is to essentially say that you have to take your eyes off the ball, even if briefly. We tend to believe that what we need to do is stay very, very focused, keep our eyes on the ball, in fact. But if we do that, we're shutting out surprises. We think of those as outliers, or we think of those as nuisances, as distractions. We tend to shut out serendipity and randomness. And even if they do happen, we don't really have allowed ourselves enough time to explore it. And if you think of somebody like, say, Howard Schultz, so he's the CEO of Starbucks, and of course Starbucks has done extremely well all over the world. But Starbucks didn't start out selling coffee by the cup. I mean, they sold coffee by the pound. They sold coffee beans, and they sold coffee makers. And in 1983, he went to Milan in Italy to a houseware conference, right? And so to look at coffee makers. And while he's there, he sort of accidentally stumbles into an espresso bar. And he's like, what is this? What's happening here? He's surprised by it. Now, think about that. The CEO of Starbucks walks into an espresso bar, and he goes, what's going on? He doesn't know.
Well, isn't that cool? Yeah.
And then, exactly. And so he sees the great environment that's there, and he has an insight. He has a click moment, and that is that Starbucks does it all wrong. They shouldn't sell coffee by the pound. They should sell it by the cup. They should tap into this communal experience that he felt was in place in Milan. And, of course, after that, he went on and ultimately made Starbucks into what it became today. But here's the thing that I think is important. Think of yourself when you travel, when you have to go to a conference. How do you structure that time? Is it filling the schedule completely, having as many meetings as possible, hitting all your targets and goals? It tends to be. That tends to be how we think of being effective. But what I say is, if you want to increase randomness in life, you have to take your eyes off the ball occasionally. That's what Howard Schultz did, and it led to Starbucks as we know it today.
And when he came back, he did not instantly sell all the coffee makers in the shop and sell only coffee by the cup. He made a transition somewhat gradually.
Well, that's true. So once again, going back to the random notion of success. So he comes back. And at that point, he's actually not CEO at Starbucks. So he tries to convince the people that's running Starbucks, look, I think, you know, we should sell coffee by the cup. We shouldn't sell it by the bag. And they try it out in the store. There's a small space is given to him. He gets a small counter, and he can see sort of can he sell it here? And it works out great. Okay, so there's lines out the door for this thing. But even so, the owners don't really want to go along with it. So he actually breaks out and starts his own coffee shop, which ultimately later on becomes Starbucks. He buys back the name. But here is what happened when he did that. So he went back to Italy, and he said, I'm going to essentially analyze my way to success. He probably spent something like 500 hours videotaping and recording various espresso bars throughout the country. And he said, I think I know exactly what a coffee shop needs to look like. And so when he opened the first coffee shop, it had no chairs because, you know, why would you want to sit in a Starbucks? All the menu items were in Italian. They played opera on the speakers, and the baristas were dressed in bow ties. Mm-hmm. That's how far sort of all this analysis led him. And, of course, it was wrong, but it was a small bet. And he was able to iterate. He was able to change his way and actually try out something else, which ultimately became the Starbucks as we know it.
So when you talk about small bets, there's also the factor that you write about here, the psychological factor called risk homeostasis. What is
yeah.
that?
Well, you know, one of the things that we tend to believe is that, if we just had more money for more time, we could increase the chance of success when we try a new project or a new initiative. And it almost seems obvious, right? If you have somebody gets $10,000, somebody gets $1 million, who's going to have the best chance of success? And everybody would sort of say, well, it's going to be the person with $1 million. But it doesn't really work out that way, okay? We know this, of course, empirically, or even anecdotally. Just looking around, you can see some of the largest companies in the world start out very, very small. But there's a reason for that, and this is what risk homeostasis is all about. Risk homeostasis essentially says that you compensate for taking higher risk in one area of life by taking a lower risk in another. So, for instance, and vice versa. So if you drive your car and the road gets, very slippery and dark, you slow down. And if the road is sort of broad and safe and the roads are dry and the sun is shining, you speed up. And this seems very obvious. But what happens is that the risk of an accident is the same in both sections of the road because you drove much slower when the weather conditions were dangerous and you drove much faster when they weren't. Well, this is true for business as well. Apple spent $500 million developing the Apple Newton, which was a complete failure.
Yeah, I want to say the what?
Yeah, the what, exactly, right? I mean, if you're using one of these, it means you're working in a museum. Now, if at the same time, the Palm company, Palm Computing, mm-hmm. spent $3 million developing the Palm Pilot. And I'd like to ask questions, why they think that Palm only spent $3 million developing the Palm Pilot, which was, by the way, one of the most successful computer products of the 90s. And the reason, of course, is because they didn't have any more. So with $3 million, they acted in a very different way than if you had $500 million. Apple bought companies, they hired people, they drove faster because the road was safer. So all of this is to say, if you get an idea and you want to try it, then having more money is not going to increase your chance of success because as soon as you get that money, you're going to spend it. And this is one of the most counterintuitive notions of what it takes to place sort of a bet. It comes down to that, and that's what risk homeostasis is. It affects us in all aspects of life, and it's a very exciting area.
And I guess it doesn't hurt to have multiple bets going at one time. It's almost like putting down chips on, I'm not really a gambler, but going to Vegas and putting down chips on multiple roulette numbers at once.
Yeah, well, it's a good analogy. I was just in Vegas this past weekend. For a bachelor party. So there was some gambling going on there.
Did you have a click moment?
Yeah, and some click moments. And you can put chips down on different bets that you make. But what I will say about that is that people are different. Some people can do that, and some people will just be really distracted by it. I think it's an individual choice. And certainly the same is even true for companies. Hmm. Some companies are good at placing multiple bets. Others at having a rapid sequence of bets. Either way, the math works out the same, which is that either you iterate quickly on something or you may try many things and some of them work or not work. There's a wonderful story in my book, The Quick Moment, where the owners of this husband and wife couple, and they open a store in Brooklyn, which they call the Chocolate Room. Now, the reason for this is because they love chocolate, mm-hmm. and they want to create the sort of the single best chocolate cake in New York City. They start by eating their way through all the chocolate cakes that exist there, and they say, none of them taste like we wanted to, so we're going to create our own. And it takes them a year. Right? They try various versions of the recipe this way, that way. Should it be two layers, three layers? Where should the sugar be sourced from, and so on? And finally, in the end, they come up with it, and their store takes off one sort of Omec gets a piece on them. It's an amazing chocolate cake. Now, what they did there was essentially they placed a very, very high number of bets, but in sequence. And I think for many people, that is how things work. And another example of that is Bethany Frankel, who I, you know, compared to Picasso. And people would say, well, you can't do that. Picasso was one of the greatest artists, in fact, was probably the greatest artist who ever lived. And Bethany Frankel wasn't. Okay, fine. But both of them utilized the approach placing sort of many bets. Picasso made 50,000 works of art in his lifetime. You know, most of those works of art were collecting dust in basements around the world because they were no good. And Bethany Frankel probably launched, I think, 10 separate business ideas before she finally came up with Skinny Girl Margarita, which she also sold for $65 million. But the first 9 didn't really work out. In both cases, the using randomness to the statistical advantage, placing many bets.
What is a collision-prone environment?
A collision-prone environment is an environment where you are inviting randomness. So, many times in an office, for instance, and even how we structure our life, honestly, it's sort of along various groupings and compartments. We compartmentalize. We have certain groups of friends, and in the office we have divisions, and we sort of split them apart, which means that if I want to say that I work in a particular division and I want to talk to somebody in finance, well, then I will get up and I'll go over there and I'll talk to the person in finance. But there's nothing serendipitous about that, right? I'm doing exactly what I plan to do, and then that is what happens. A collision-prone environment is one where you actually encourage unexpected meetings to happen. So, for instance, when I'm on my way to this person in finance, I bump into somebody else. Maybe I bump into somebody who's handling overseas sales. And we end up having a conversation. It's maybe a brief conversation, but it gets me in a direction I had never expected. And what I say is that these types of conversations are far more powerful. And many organizations, increasingly today, are trying to find ways to create collision-prone environments. The one I mentioned here is Pixar. I actually had a session with Ed Catmull, who's the president of Pixar, earlier this year, and he was talking about how they really try to encourage this sort of random interaction, creating an environment where, you know, people, they place these sort of bathrooms in the middle of their building so that everybody has to go to it, and when you do, you're going to bounce into other people that you didn't expect to meet.
You know, it comes down again, friends, to this idea of taking your eye off the ball. I think a lot of people sense, okay, if I'm in the office for 8 hours or 10 hours, I ought to be nose to the grindstone, focusing only on the task at hand for that entire time. And it sounds like there's a tremendous value to taking a break now and then, talking about something that may not even relate to what's happening at work. You may say, hey, how did your kid's team do last Saturday on the baseball field?
So, absolutely. And the question is, where do we get these sort of impressions from that sort of can help us hit upon something serendipitous? Clearly it's not what we think is going to be, because if it is what we think is going to be, it's not serendipitous. This is sort of the cause and paradox that we get back to. Well, who should I talk to, people ask me. Well, if you knew that, how is that serendipity?
Right.
So essentially, it needs to be something that we may have an interest in, but we don't think it relates to what we're working on. We help companies do this all the time, and I call this intersectional thinking. There's a great story in the book that I just love it, which is the invention of the burkini, where a woman named Hida Sinetti, who's a traditional Muslim woman, she moves from Lebanon to Australia. She realizes that essentially, if she is to, you know, in Australia, they have a particular way of dressing on the beach, which for women tends to be in bikinis. While that is completely unacceptable for her and many of her friends, in fact, they'd be walking around in something like hijabs and niqabs and burqas, but those are extremely uncomfortable, and you wouldn't go swimming in those or go surfing in them. Well, for an outsider or for anybody else, combining the idea of a bikini with a burqa wouldn't make any sense at all. Essentially, they're opposites. But all of a sudden, she had a serendipitous insight. It came when she saw her niece play a game of sort of Australian basketball, that she could combine these things. And she created the burkini, which is sort of essentially a burqa out of sort of bikini material and cuts. and you know, our company's taken off like crazy since then. It doesn't come from a rational or logical exploration of what the next step in the bikini market is. It comes by being open to the impressions we have around us, particularly those impressions that we don't think are going to be directly related to what we're doing.
What do you say, friends, to clients who are trying to figure out whether they have a fantastic idea like the iPhone, like the Kindle, like the burkini, or whether they're sort of working on the next, you know, automatic dog treat dispenser and maybe it's not worth their time?
Well, I will say at least two things. One is that passion is absolutely critical. It's probably the most important metric to use. Hmm. In trying to figure out which ideas to go for. So, we talked earlier today about ROI, but in the click moment, I say that's not helpful. But passion is. Because the reason passion is helpful is because you have to expect to fail on your first attempt, or second, or third, or fourth. And the only thing that's going to give you the wherewithal to last through those mistakes and failures is if you feel something for this idea, if you have passion for it. So it is the absolutely most important criteria of selecting an idea, and is because of the random nature of success. You're going to have to try a few times. You don't even know how many times. That's the first thing. The other thing is the iPhone or the Kindle or whatever it is that you're looking at were not created from scratch. It wasn't like somebody sat down and said, I've got it, here it is. Another wonderful story that I like in the book is around the creation of the ICE Hotel.
You know what, let me have you pause there because we're going to take a quick break and I want to hear this whole story because it's a great one. My guest is Franz Johansson, entrepreneur, strategy consultant, and author of The Click Moment, Seizing Opportunity in an Unpredictable World. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is entrepreneur and strategy consultant Franz Johansson, author of the new book, The Click Moment, Seizing Opportunity in an Unpredictable World. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. So, Franz, you were about to tell us about the click moment of the ICE Hotel, this thing that is 125 miles north of the Arctic Circle.
Yeah. So the point I was going to make around the ICE Hotel is this. If you hear a description of this hotel, it sounds insane, right? So the entire hotel is made out of ice. The floor's made out of ice. The ceiling, you know, the roof, the bed you sleep on, the tables, the glass you drink from. This idea shouldn't really work, but it has worked. It is actually one of Sweden's largest tourist attractions, and today it's spread to a number of other countries as well. Well, okay. Then all of a sudden our impressions change. The guy behind it then must have been brilliant.
Right.
A brilliant genius. I mean, where other people just saw, you know, frozen tundra, he saw an ice palace or economic development opportunity. Well, is that true? And actually, by the way, this is the type of reaction we have with almost every single really truly innovative product or service or whatnot. And the fact is that what he did was he didn't start with the ice hotel. He started with a simple ice exhibit where he flew some ice sculptures over from Japan, and they put together, you know, some ice eagles and an ice reindeer and so on. And that was you know, that was an okay idea, but it wasn't really what he wanted to do. So Yngve, as the founder of the Ice Hotel is called, he went on the next winter to do building made out of snow, where he had an ice exhibit. That wasn't it either, and he went on and created a, you know, an ice expo in a building made entirely out of ice. And that was when somebody came up to him and said, look, we'd like to sleep on a bed made out of ice. And he found he was able to charge for that. He thought they were crazy, but, you know, they were willing to pay. And then after that, he said, you know what, maybe I should just create a whole building with ice beds.
Hmm.
And that's how the Ice Hotel happened. That's how almost every single groundbreaking idea happens. It doesn't start with the amazing final product. And anybody who believes that will ultimately set themselves back because they don't allow serendipity and randomness to guide them.
And I guess you also need to allow for adjusting the plan along the way.
Well, yeah. You know, when I talk to people about the way they think about their own careers, for instance, what's really interesting, I had a conversation with a professor at Harvard Business School, and I said, well, what does it take to become a professor at Harvard Business School? And she sort of outlined, well, you need to do this. There's, you know, certain steps and certain things that you sort of got to get down, and if you do that, you know, you really set yourself up. And then I said, well, what did you have to do? What did you do? And of course, then it's, oh, well, in my case, it was, you know, I met somebody at a party. I taught there for like a couple of days. Somebody saw it. They really liked it. You know, my training hadn't been in management at all. And I ended up, you know, as a professor at Harvard Business School. Well, my guess is that if you ask those two questions to most people, you're going to find a similar answer. I could ask you, what does it take to, you know, host a radio show? And you will sort of say, well, here's the things. Now, I have no idea exactly how your life has played out, but I'm going to guess that there have been certain moments in your life, Chris, where serendipity and randomness has played an absolutely critical role in getting to this point. And what I say is embrace that. Acknowledge it. Embrace that this is how success happens. And now be ready to actually look for it when it happens, to take advantage of it.
So we've had a couple of different emails come in, friends, from different people who want to know about embracing the serendipity in maybe unexpected bad things that happen in your life.
Uh-huh. So in terms of...
I guess
how
the sense of
that,
yeah, how we deal with it, I'm assuming that this is what the emailers meant, but you know, sort of learning to deal with those problems and overcoming them, but finding maybe a silver lining in something terrible.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So you know, randomness and serendipity can, you know, well, serendipity, we usually use that word to talk about good outcomes.
Yeah.
But randomness can certainly be used to talk about both good and bad outcomes. What the point I make in the book, and this is, I think this is one of the most important ones, is that when something good happens, double down on that, focus in on that. When something bad happens, of course, you want to stay clear from it. But the way to think about it is that you know it was a bet that you placed. You tried something, it didn't work, and you're better off for that reason. In fact, this is going to happen more and more for all of your listeners, because increasingly the world is becoming more unpredictable. The company you're working at, something can happen to it. Even your entire industry may face challenges. But at the same time, the other industries that are opening up, there are other companies that are sprouting out of it, and this is happening at a faster pace, much faster than ever before. And the beautiful part about it is that in such a world, you don't have to have exceptional skill. You don't have to have 10,000 hours to rule in that world. What you need is to try something different, try something that is unexpected, and have a little bit of luck.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Another great story you have in this book, friends, is about the creative team for the show Lost, which, love it or hate it, was a huge hit when it was on the air. These two guys were not actually the first ones to conceive of the idea. They felt like they sort of had nothing to lose, and so they took some risks that made the show really exciting.
You know, Lost, the click moment was the story of Lost, because I was actually a huge fan of the show up until about the last 15 minutes.
You and a lot of other people, yeah.
Yes. And so, what I found fascinating about it is that for all, if you look at it at a distance, this show looks incredibly well planned. I mean, they have this smoke monster that they introduced in the very first episode, and the origins of this smoke monster is not revealed until sort of the last season, or even the last part of the last season. I mean, it seems incredible. And in fact, I think a lot of the success of this TV show comes from all the intricacies and mysteries and that they built into the whole storyline. Well, that would make you believe that it was very well planned. And in fact, it wasn't. Lost was an idea of a guy named Lloyd Braun who really wanted to sort of create a TV show around the notion of Survivor. Sort of, he wanted to serialize the idea of that reality show. And so J.J. Abrams and Damon Lindelof thought that this idea was crazy. There's no way this is going to work. In fact, the only reason Damon agreed to join up with J.J. Abrams about this was because he had no interest in Lost. He wanted to get on Alias, which was another show that J.J. Abrams, you know, was producing, and said, look, J.J., I'll help you out, and I'll come up with ideas. And this is not going to go anywhere, but I would love to work on Alias. And so they came up with stuff that, you know, they thought there would be no way this is going to happen, right? So there's whispers on the island. There's a freaking polar bear there. And they throw these things out because there's no way this is going to get picked up. Well, guess what? It does get picked up. And not only that, Lloyd Braun picks it up without even a full screenplay. He just picks it up based off of a short treatment. And he improves the show. And Michael Eisner, who is the CEO of Disney at the time, then looks at it and says, I'm going to rate this stupid pilot a 2 out of 10. This has no chance of working out. And so here's the outcome of this, right? Lost airs and becomes one of the most successful shows. Actually, the most successful one is Desperate Housewives, which also was approved by Lloyd Braun, a show that nobody else wanted. Lloyd Braun gets fired before either one of these shows airs because Michael Eisner thinks that Lost is a complete crapshoot and it's not going to work. And ABC moves from being last to first. And, of course, Damon and JJ becomes superstars because of the success of Lost. And in none of these plays, no one in this really knew that this was going to work. And even the guy who thought it was going to work, Lloyd Braun, got fired because of it. Now, if the world moved in a predictable way, nothing in the story I just told would make any sense. But the fact is the world moves in an unpredictable way, and this happens all the time. We just have to acknowledge it.
Another thing you say it's important to acknowledge is the fact that sometimes windows open and close, and they don't open again. And you write about after Barack Obama, then Senator Barack Obama's 2004 speech before the Democratic National Convention, suddenly people know his name, and he's thinking, I don't know that I'm ready to run for higher office yet. And Tom Daschle gives him some advice.
Yeah, so Tom Daschle basically says, look, this window is open now, but you never know for how long it's going to be open. It could close at any moment. So if you're going to run, you probably should do it now. And of course, we all know how that ended. I mean, he went for it and he became president. You know, even a day before that convention speech that he gave in 2004, no one would have predicted such a fate for Barack Obama. And it all changed. It all changed in one click moment. And this is true over and over again, particularly in politics.
Let's go to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Venky on the line in Coppell. Hi, Venky.
Hi.
Hello.
This
How
is
you
Venky
doing?
From Coppell, Texas. Very interesting program, and I just ordered your book online. So I also sent
Thanks.
A question regarding how adverse circumstances could potentially lead to clickable moments. And to elaborate on that question, would putting yourself into adverse situations deliberately, I don't mean in terms of physical danger, but in terms of where you could potentially lose big, lead to a more number of clickable moments? So rather than taking the easy way out, you take a chance and take a chance where a risk where you might lose big. But
right.
then you might end up seeing some clickable moments that you might otherwise not have seen.
Yeah, so what I talk about in the book, and which gets close to what you're talking about, is rejecting the obvious path. Right? The obvious path is will not lead to serendipity because it is, you know, it's obvious, so serendipity is really nowhere in sight. So what happens if you say, okay, this is the obvious path, I'm simply going to remove that as an option? What it does is it now opens you up for seeing other solutions that you might not otherwise have seen. And so one of the stories I tell about in the book about this is around Marcus Samuelson, who's the chef of the restaurant Red Rooster here in New York, and how he became selected to do the state dinner when the Indian Prime Minister came to the States. Now, he was in a race against, I think, something like 15 other chefs, all, you know, well-known chefs. And the way this works is that for state dinners, really throughout history, all state dinners have essentially been French-American cuisine. So that was stated up front. You know, this should be French-American cuisine. And so what Marcus said was, okay, I'm just going to reject this obvious choice, even though it was sort of outlined. And what happened then? And what happened was that he now began to have a number of click moments. He realized that, Prime Minister Singh was a vegetarian. So French-American cuisine usually has a lot of meat. Maybe we should stay away from meat. Maybe we'll have, you know, some type of fish or prawn. Once he went down the vegetarian road, he realized that Michelle Obama had a garden in the White House garden. Maybe they could take vegetables from there. And all of a sudden, he came up with something. Now, here's the thing. He says that either they were going to go for his idea or they weren't. Let's say that the chance of them going for his idea was, you know, say 25%. Well, that's still better than if he had to compete with all of the 15 chefs in French-American cuisine. He stood apart. He did something different. And it came as a result of exposing himself to cook moments and in your language, putting yourself in quote-unquote danger because you're doing something that is not obvious.
We just have a few seconds left, but I want to ask you, Franz, if you feel like your really interesting sort of global personal history gives you a better ability to spot click moments and to sort of recognize interesting trends and ideas when they occur to you.
That's a good question. I certainly think, you know, my background is a little bit unique. My mother is African American and Cherokee. My dad is Swedish. I grew up in Sweden, and then I came over here to study in college and start a number of companies. And all throughout, I've seen that. I think it's true that I've seen throughout my life that the true underlying drivers of success are far more intuitive, far more serendipitous than virtually every single, you know, certainly business book or career book out there sort of claim. They really want to give you a plan, but the plan should be to expose yourself to something unexpected. And when you find it, you go for it.
Franz Johansson's new book is called The Click Moment, Seizing Opportunity in an Unpredictable World. Franz, thanks so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. KERA.org/think is where you go to download the free daily podcast and check out upcoming programs. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, you can send them to think@KERA.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.